Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and thank you for joining me for another episode of New Books in Islamic Studies. I'm your host, Shobhan Azabian. How are notions of justice and equality constructed in Islamic virtue ethics? How are Islamic virtue ethics gendered despite their venture into perennial concerns of how best to live a good and ethical life? These are the questions that Zahra Ayoubian, an assistant professor of religion at Dartmouth College, examines in her new book, Gendered Morality, Classical Islamic Ethics of the Self, Family, and Society, published by Columbia University Press. Using eclectic literature by Al-Ghazali, Dawani, and Tusi, Ayoubi closely studies the ways in which these male Muslim scholars and thinkers constructed ideas of the self, particularly in relation to the family and the society. Despite the ethicists' differing sectarian and theological orientations in Islam, they still concluded that the status of a perfect ethical human was only achievable by a male elite, meaning that the capacity to utilize rational faculty, which is central to self-refinement, was not deemed accessible to females, slaves, and non-elite males. In unpacking these gendered and hierarchical dynamics around ethics and comportment, Ayoubi masterfully applies feminist and gender analysis to deconstruct ethical texts. In light of her findings, she calls for a philosophical turn that must employ critical gender analysis when reading these texts, not only in the context of Islamic philosophy, but broadly in the study of Islam. The book is a must-read for scholars and students interested in Islamic philosophy and gender and Islamic studies. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Zahra Ayoubi. Hi, thank you so much for joining us today. We have a tradition in New Books in Islamic Studies to start off conversations with our authors and guests in terms of asking them to share a little bit about what their own intellectual journey has been and what led them to writing this particular book.
It's a rather, I guess, long story, but I'll try to give you the highlights. I suppose I was always interested in issues of gender and Islam from when I was a young child. My parents had always filled our home with books on Islam, and I was always attracted to the ones that I could relate to. So I always read the women in Islam books, and God knows what was in them. But certainly when I got to high school and college, the interest remained, and the world of academia actually opened up to me when I started taking classes on Islam and gender in Islam, in particular, with Keisha Elliott Brandeis University. This was back when she was a postdoctoral fellow there, and that sort of opened up a world of studying Islam from an academic perspective. And then when I got to UNC Chapel Hill for my PhD program, the interest obviously was studying Islam was driven by questions of gender and women's experiences and so on. So what I ended up doing is, initially I thought I would be studying gender in Islamic law or women's experiences in Islamic law or doing feminist critique of Islamic law. And that to me, I mean, certainly their interest broadly remains, but I very quickly realized at the time that there were lots of studies that were sort of looking at lots of details and sort of finer issues, but I more or less gravitated towards larger questions, larger philosophical questions, which led me to the genre of Islamic ethics. And also while at UNC, there was so much emphasis on sort of the anti-canon and the non-Arabic non-Arabic canon that I was sort of pulled towards reading Persian texts and Sufi texts and so on and so forth. And so it was this cross-genre investigation of the thematics that I was interested in, of the questions of gender and questions of women's roles and gender roles and so on and so forth. Which ultimately led me to, because I already had that interest in sort of broader philosophical questions, ultimately led me to the ethics texts that I investigated for my dissertation. And then after my PhD, I continued sort of researching that and rewriting that dissertation. And then ultimately that turned into this book.
And that gives me, and I think a lot of the readers, a lot of context to what it is that you're doing in this book, very important book. And one of the things you do focus on is virtue ethics. And so I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what that is, especially in the context of Islamic philosophy, because at the beginning you do talk to us about the origins of Islamic philosophy and even the question of what one can say is Islamic philosophy, right? So I wonder if you could guide us through some of the questions that you're asking, which then hopefully will get us to the texts, the three main texts that you're dealing with.
Sure. So, I do spend a good chunk of the book on thinking about what is Islamic ethics to begin with, right? And, I treat it as an academic construct. It's not an actual thing, right? It's a category that academics have used or put together, and in order to describe a whole host of prescriptive texts that deal with the question of how to live, right? How Muslims should live, and it's definitely a cross-genre type of category, right? So there's obviously the Quran and Hadith, right, which are sort of the foundational scriptural texts, and people look to those texts specifically for Islamic ethical precepts. But then also there's the intellectual tradition, right? So the cross genres of fiqh and kalam and Adab, and in my case, and Tasawwuf as well. And in my case, I'm interested in the Akhlaq tradition, which is the philosophical ethics tradition, or virtue ethics tradition, as some people like to call it, that is really focused on the question of how to live from a more cosmic perspective. And with the perspective of, what's the goal of life? What's the purpose of living here on Earth? And how are human beings supposed to live and interact with one another? And how are we supposed to live as individuals in a family and in a society, right? So that's really the primary questions that the texts I'm working on are asking. And so when I talk about virtue ethics and Islamic ethics and my feminist critique of it, I'm really thinking through the issues of how are these texts, who are these texts speaking to, right? That's the very first sort of question that comes up when you think about virtue ethics for me is, who's the audience and who are the people that are supposed to be refining themselves according to these texts? And that is what sort of bursts open a whole host of questions that I'm dealing with.
And in order to answer these questions, you're really dealing with three main primary sources. The authors. But what I'm really fascinated about is how you bring these texts, which I guess many people would say could be different and maybe even dissonant based on sectarian differences and backgrounds, but you bring them together and you treat them as a cohesive group. So I wonder if you could walk us through the texts that you're using, your methodological process, and what was some of the challenges of dealing with these texts?
Thanks for that question, because I don't really have the opportunity to talk about my methodology as much you know, women in Islam is such a, is the kind of topic, or gender in Islam is the kind of topic where everyone wants to really jump to the bite of, you know, well, what's really going on? What's the, you know, the, what's the status of women in Islam? Is that the big, sort of, the big question that a lot of people like to jump to, but really it's actually the methodology is actually really important for me and for my book and some of the arguments that I create in the book, because it doesn't try to get to the bottom line immediately. I think one of the things that I do in the book, one of the things that I'm arguing is that it's actually specifically through the question of understanding masculinity and femininity and gender relations in the texts that that I'm able to get to some of the bigger questions about how to live, right? That the texts are asking, and really get to the heart of the critique of hierarchy and patriarchy, and exclusionary ethics, right? And it's specifically through the methodology of asking about gender and doing that gender critique. The texts themselves that I'm dealing with, the three texts by Ghazali and Nasreddin Tusi and Dawani, are some people like to put them together because the texts themselves are kind of speaking to each other in a way. Tusi quotes Ghazali, Dawani quotes both Ghazali and Tusi. So that's there's an interesting bit of intertextuality there. But also, I mean, they are part, and I argue this in the book, they are part of a cohesive tradition that draws on Aristotelian ethics in a way that creates a male normative universe, right? Through the building blocks of the virtue ethics of the self, and that cohesiveness is also seen in the arc of each of these texts, right? They're talking about individual refinement, but they're also talking about the individual's role in family and society, and that particular feature of the text actually, in my opinion, sort of lends them to to be analyzed together. And then once you do that, you realize, and once you sort of once I looked at the text together, I realized that even though Ghazali is, you know, very much in many ways diametrically opposed to the camp that Nasreddin Tusi comes from, for example, right? So he engages in polemics against the societies for much of his career. And even though Dawani is sort of writes from both Shia and Sunni perspectives. And so even though they come from very different backgrounds, sectarian backgrounds, when you look at them together, you realize, for the reason that I said already, in the sense that they follow a similar sort of arc of the self, family, and society, when you do a gender critique of these texts, you realize they're actually, when it comes to gender, they are actually rather similar, right? So they're not identical, certainly, but they're assumptions about masculinity and femininity and gender role relations and how and what kind of men should emerge from ethical refinement and how those men should be ordering women and enslaved persons and ordering their community and their society, broadly speaking. Those ideas end up being very similar across all three texts. So in terms of challenges, I would say initially one of the challenges would be what it was actually to articulate why I am analyzing these three texts together. right? That was one of the challenges early on, and it was sort of this intuition and this hunch that I was operating on, and of course as I did the research and as I did close readings, it became sort of clearer to me that that it's the analytic of gender allows us to see the similarities, but more profoundly, I think the analytic of gender allows us to see across all three texts the ways in which how masculinity emerges as almost synonymous with ethics itself, right? Good masculinity and good ethics are the same, and that is cultivated through, particularly through the suppression of everyone else in service to that refinement.
And this leads us to the heart of the analysis that you do for us, which is bringing together gender analysis, feminist analysis, masculinity studies, and really contending with these three figures and thinking about how they construct certain hierarchies. And you divide it up in terms of dealing with the self, the family, and then society. So I wonder if we could go through this process, particularly in terms of the self. I was really fascinated by the metaphysical tensions that you highlight in terms of gender and how to think of the self, either the way sometimes the Sufis think of it, the self, and this is where I think even starting from the self that then constructs to the family, then constructs to the society, it all begins at such an individual level. But that individual level, you're noticing in your analysis, is already fraught, but is also gendered in a very specific way. So I wonder if you could unpack that and some of the things you noticed across, to see Divani, Ghazali, specifically.
Sure. So they're all three texts are spend. I guess I don't know. At least a third, if not more. At least a third of their space on how to live as an individual, right, and how to refine the nafs. And for them, as with many pre-modern thinkers, Ghazali and Tusi and Divani, they've written in multiple genres, right? They write in Sufi form, they write in sometimes in scientific form, they write in legal form, and so here in this particular genre of akhlaq, they're operating on a definition of nafs that's slightly different from what we're used to in Sufi discourse, the nafs being more or less unruly and in need of refinement. In this genre, the nafs is actually not all bad, right? So the nafs, particularly the rational self, the rational faculty, the quwwat al-aqli, is actually the best part of the nafs, and that is the thing that all three of our thinkers want to amplify as much as possible, and they do so sort of slightly differently from one another, right? Ghazali likes to use animal metaphors. Tusi also talks about animals as well. Divani likes to think of the self as entirely in a positive light, and so for him, the rational faculty is something that can never actually go bad, go wrong. Neither for Ghazali, actually, for that matter. But each of them breaks down a rather similar cosmology of the self, and they have the rational faculty, the irascible faculty, and then the concupiscent faculty. The rational is obviously the best, and they are outline virtues and vices for each one. So the virtue that corresponds to the rational faculty is wisdom, right? So quick thinking and lucidity and elegance of mind and excellence of memory and recollection and so on. The irascible faculty is it too has has virtues, but it's by nature, it's the anger, and it's the faculty that sort of repels harm. And so it causes a lot of problems for people, in that if you have too little of it, then you can be cowardly. If you have too much of it, then you're sort of angry and boastful and prideful and impetuous, reckless. But if you can manage to balance it just right, then you can, hone it for its virtue, which is courage and honor and valor, and boldness of soul and so on and so forth. So it's actually supposed to be subdued to the rational faculty, but it also has its own virtue. And then the concupiscent faculty, which is the third one, it's the faculty that by nature it attracts benefits to the self. And that one, if you have too little of it, then you're unmanly. And if you have too much of it, then you're greedy and gluttonous. And it's often sort of reduced to sexual desire, but it's not just sexual desire. It's also attracting, food and other benefits as well. So when that faculty is, at its best and put into proper balance, and subdued to the rational faculty, then it can sort of create self-restraint and modesty and elegance and tranquility of the soul and things like that. So it's not that the nafs is entirely bad. It's just that it needs to be whipped into shape, right? You mentioned the argument of that portion of the book, which is that already we see that all of these terms that I've just described about how the soul is and so on and so forth, it's not gender neutral, right? So they are these Ghazali and Tusi and Zavani are deliberately speaking about the soul in terms that their audience will understand. And a lot of the examples that emerge from that section of those sections of their treatises are specifically male-oriented examples, right? So they're talking about men taking wives at given time periods in their life in order to subdue the concupiscent faculty. They're talking about the virtue of wisdom and the generosity and the kindness that emerges from sense of justice that emerges from sort of the composite of all of the virtues combined. Those are specifically the providence of men, right? The dominion of men, because they're talking about how men are supposed to order their own selves, their nafses, in order to be a force for justice, in order to be, in order to order others in their lives, right? And their wives and their servants and slaves and their children and so on and so forth. And so all of these are sort of building blocks. The explanation of the nafs is actually the building block of the next step, which is what do you do with this highly trained self? Well, you subdue others and you order others and so on and so forth, who don't have the ability to, either the rational capability or the ability because of whatever reason to refine themselves, right? And so already what we see from the very beginning of the treatises that the nafs is described in these male terms, and the refinement that they're talking about, that the ethicists are talking about, is specifically relying on the refinement takes place and is achieved by the ways in which men interact with women and non-elites and so on and so forth. So that's that's already normative, as you picked up on.
And we see this really in the next chapter in discussion of marriage and how the ideal wife is spoken about and how the male with, you know, rational faculty is supposed to relate to this ideal wife. And the relational context is quite, I mean, it's difficult to read as a female, right? But it is fascinating that this idea of rationality seems, at least in discussions of the women or as an ideal mother, ideal wife, is rationality is not accessible or achievable to women. Right. And so the women seem to be just there to help the males refine themselves further and refine their nafs further.
Yeah, exactly. So from the get-go, we see this tension, which I call it the metaphysical tension in my book, which I basically, you know, is a term that I'm using to describe how these three ethicists think of women, right? So they spend a lot of time on, or not a lot of time, but they spend a considerable amount of time accepting the fact that, or, you know, they admit that women too have nefses, right? And they also talk about how, Ghazali has this wonderful line, you know, well, women's nefses are just like your own, you know, so treat them with care. It's women also have nefses just like your own. So, you know, that's sort of why you have to beware, right? Because they also will be having various natural proclivities and things like that in the same way that you do. And so that's why it's really important to control them in particular way. Yeah. And rather than saying, okay, well, you know, they too have nefses, and, you know, that's why you can allow them to give them their space, and they can also achieve what they need to achieve. That's not what's happening, right? So that's why there's this metaphysical tension, right? In that Ghazali and Tusi and Devani, they all recognize that women are human beings, and they recognize that women have nefses, and they also, each of them talks, says in a very, in sort of different ways, they say, they also talk about matter, and Tusi in particular talks about atoms and matter, and how all matter is sort of created equal by God, and because all matter is created equal, you know, you have to sort of tread lightly and so on, but when it comes to specifically to talking about gender relations or relationships with women in particular, they're talking about wives and a little bit about mothers. It's this disconnect. Well, you know, that all that recognition of their humanity and equality of atoms goes out the window, and they sort of can't help themselves but talk about the hierarchy, right? And the hierarchical or the patriarchal rather status quo that needs to be preserved at all costs, because that is ultimately what will help the men in turn to achieve their refinement. And so we see throughout this throughout the chapters on the chapters on marriage across the three treatises, we see the relationship between husband and wife is really one of utilization, and women are in service to men from their bodies, you know, bearing children, and from their souls in terms of, you know, subduing and subjugating their own needs over their husband's needs, so that they may achieve refinement, and that looks like various kinds of sacrifices that the ethicists name. You know, whether it's for example, cooking and cleaning and so on, that the wives do in order to, quote, give their husbands leave, right, as one line Ali, in order to, you know, so that that's one of the wonderful things that wives can do for husbands is sort of the way that Ghazali frames it. And you know, and they, in a sense, you know, and it's odd because they recognize how it is a sacrifice for women on some level, right? Because they also, and Ghazali and Tusi and Devani, each of them talks about how marriage is kind of like slavery, and you know, which is actually, you know, an idea that Keisha Ali talks about in her book *American Slavery* but from a legal perspective, and it's just a rather, it's a little bit different. But here they're talking about marriage as slavery in the sense that it's the relationship, the kinds of the marital dynamic. You know, one has to be kind to the wife because the wife is kind of like a slave. And so they recognize that it's this lot in life, right? And for women, but they're not apologetic about it at all, because, as you said, for them, women have less intellect. They're, God has given them, according to see Ghazali and Devani, you know, God has given them less intellect, less rationality, and they are very, very easily, very easily succumb to the other two faculties of the nafs, the concupiscence and the arousal, and particularly the concupiscence faculty. And so they're unable to control themselves. And that's why it's men's job to do that. And so, you know, while they recognize their humanity, it's sort of a very flawed humanity. And so the question is, well, if they don't have rationality in the same way, according to these ethicists, that men, in the same way that men do, then are they less human? You know. So that's really the question that emerges. And so the definition of humanity becomes shaky, and the texts then become very contradictory when you pay attention to the gender relations.
And you notice this is particularly when they're discussing divorce or ways in which to get divorced, I thought. And particularly, I think, Tusi, who is saying that, figuring out ways to manipulate the wife, like an ethical manipulation to get a divorce. And so there was a way in which it was, you know, I'm trying to navigate the woman in a very patronizing and condescending way to get her to think that she was initiating or wanting the divorce. And there's like kind of deep discussions, which all three of them are doing, and which kind of signal to what you're referring to, right, in terms of how they thought women did not have the capacity to be rational, that they could manipulate.
Yeah, the divorce moment in Tusi is actually really, I mean, it's sad but fun to read, and because he's really advocating for men to, you know, be tricky and in a world in which really there is absolutely no impediment upon men to just unilaterally divorce their wives, right? I mean, legally speaking, they can do it at any time, right? And unilaterally and irrevocably, very, you know, if they do the triple block, but even if they don't do triple block, right? So it's they can pronounce it at any time. And so for Tusi to then tell the men, the male readers, you know, actually, you know, try your best so that she desires divorce, and try your best to sort of, you know, be sneaky and try to get her to divorce you, is really curious, because, you know, why would that be the case? I mean, I would understand it if this were, you know, the kind of advice that's given to women, you know, your husband is so bad, why don't you try to do what you can to get him to divorce you? But in this case, this advice to men is really interesting. And the only thing that makes sense to me is that he realizes on some level that it's a kind of a cruelty to divorce someone, to divorce a woman, right? In that particular context, in that world, and in his world, it is a kind of cruelty. And I mean, and that's something that the Ghazali talks about is, you know, be really careful and be really kind when you have to, when you divorce, because it is, you know, it's a cruelty. And we're talking about, you know, woman's means of livelihood, certainly her reputation, and so on and so forth. But Tosi is not as kind, and he's sort of saying, well, you know, just trick her into wanting the divorce in the first place. And I think for him, that absolves men of the ethical responsibility to stay married. That was a really sort of shocking moment in his text.
It's fascinating, so fascinating to read. And so from the self to the family, you move in your last chapter to one of the most fascinating aspects, which is thinking about the society. And in your discussion of this, you're thinking about homosocial masculinity. And I wonder if you could unpack that for us. And because what you are presenting to us is this idea that there's actually a very specific type of male ideal that is being presented in these virtue ethic texts, right? And something that's actually accessible to all, not only women, but also to actually some non-elite men. And so what kind of masculinity is being presented?
Yeah, so the masculinity that the ethicists are trying to inculcate in the reader is elite, right? So they are specifically talking to men of means, men who have some sort of power over, these are men who have, you know, in terms of socioeconomics, they have the means to get married. So that already shows that they have some sort of wealth. They have the means to have servants and slaves as well, as part of their household, because that's another thing that sort of they, all three of them, take for granted. They talk about, they don't talk about it at great length in these particular texts, but you know, there are enslaved people that are sort of in the background, in the household and potentially at court and other places that they're encountering. And then they also talk about underlings, right? So these are people who are professionally under someone, whether they are apprentices or a particular craft or something, a particular knowledge, and so on. So pupils, and so they talk about that, and then they talk about also behavior at court, right? So these are people who have access to royalty or to the ruling class, and so in and of themselves, this is a pretty elite bunch that they're speaking to, and that, you know, if you notice all of those things, then you also realize then that if the audience is made up of these men, these elite men, then this is specifically elite masculinity that they're talking about. And I found that the homosociality was a really useful framework through which very useful lens through which to look at the chapters in on social relations, on society and the city, and so on and so forth, in the treatises, because one can ask that, or what I do is I ask, okay, well, who are the equals, right? And how is one supposed to treat an equal? And and that's another giveaway, right? Is when they talk about the principles of friendship, they're specifically talking about men, of course, men's friendship with other men, and under what circumstances and under what kinds of situations are they specifically talking about, and the social circles and the kinds of guidelines, like the way that you should talk to a friend and what kind of relationship one is supposed to have with another man, are other things that sort of indicate both the class, but also the kind of masculinity that is supposed to be, the kind of homosocial relationship that's supposed to be emerging from these texts, is someone who, a man who is who is only able to achieve full companionship with other men of the same class. And in that friendship, one is the moment where you're actually equal, and these are companions on the path to refinement, right? And these are people who one is supposed to be guarded with initially, but then can become really, really intimate with eventually once friends get to know one another. And so and it's in that homosocial intimacy relationship that we'll see masculinity that is supposed to be one that is very, I guess, cosmic and sort of focused on the one's position in the universe, because one is supposed to think about how to how friends are supposed to be kin on this path to refinement. And and it contrasts very starkly with the relationship to underlings and enslaved people, and also to superiors too, right? Superiors particularly being ruling class and ruling elite, but any superior, right? Perhaps someone at court, or some sort of clerk or munchi, right, at court, for example, right, could be once superior. And so we see in the competition between men, particularly when the ethicists talk about how to deal with superiors, it's in that competition between men that you see how women also come into play, because it's not that inferior men become women in that kind of relationship with superiors and inferiors across different classes, but they compete with one another in terms of their masculinity, in terms of their akhlaq, in terms of their ethics, right? And when I say compete, I mean that they are essentially displaying the best kind of behavior possible, and the kinds of relationships that men have with one another on a societal level are specifically about achieving something while behaving the best, right? And that, in a sense, becomes a kind of competition. And so women become the foil and the other, and they are, and even in the chapters, in the treatises on, in the chapters on social life, Susi and Devani in particular, they keep bringing up sort of women as a foil often, and Ghazali does too. All of them say something to the effect of, well, don't ever share the secrets that you have, with your friends, with your wife, or with women. Don't ever talk about court matters or politics with women, and because they're weak-minded and so on and so forth. And so they bring up women even when they're not there, right? I mean, in real life, probably women were everywhere. Men and women were everywhere, but there was probably plenty of gender mixing. But in their ideal world, certainly there's gender segregation. But still, they keep bringing up women as sort of the unruly and irrational other. When they talk about relationships with men, so that's the kind of picture that emerges is a man who is steadfast in his friendship, and his and he treats inferiors with dignity, and enslaved people with a kindness, and inferiors and underlings with a kindness, and here they are not. And it's interesting to contrast the way that they talk about inferiors, because they're talking specifically about men. You don't always talk about the less rational persons, except for when they talk about enslaved people, right? When they're talking about slaves, then yes, they're talking about people who they believe were less rational and had deficiencies. But other than that, when they talk about other men, they don't really go there because, you know, that would blow up a lot of things. And I mean, in their mind, they're talking about men dealing with other men and how you do it best is present your best self and be kind and so on and so forth. So, and be careful of people who are cunning and tricky and are trying to get ahead in society and, you know, quashing other men in the process. And so it's a tough world that they're describing, actually, but one in which you're supposed to be able to subdue, meaning you're supposed to be able to order those who are under you and be in good service and good ethic with those who are above you.
It's very, the hierarchy is very interesting, right? In the context of these social relationships that men are having, are they, the ethicists, discussing instances of same-sex intimacy, especially between males, or moments in which a social relationship between two elite men get into an instances of ambiguity that is beyond a friendship?
I mean, I'm sure that they observe that in real life. And so there are these really fleeting moments where they talk about, where they sort of touch on a homosocial relationship that, you know, borders on what they believed was impropriety, right? So Ghazali talks about bathhouse etiquette in this wonderful section where he says, you know, men should not be touching one another below the belt. And, you know, and even the bathhouse attendant should, you know, not actually, you know, place his hand under one's towel or cloth or whatever the term was, I forget. Because touching is like seeing. And so, you know, for Ghazali, there is a line, right, that you can't cross, which, you know, I describe it as, you know, this is not just, you know, homosocial life, but this is also, you know, sort of pre-modern heteronormativity we're talking about that they're creating as well, in which men are supposed to be above women and men are equal to other elite men are equal to other elite men. But there is a line in which you can't cross. And that line is that, you know, you are supposed to be friends and be intimates of one another, and absolute intellectual intimates, right? So what actually emerges is that men can only be the equals of other men, and they are rational equals. But when it comes to corporeal things, when it comes to sexuality, marriage, and so on and so forth, and having sex, they only can think of women. And in that sense, women are lowly because they are corporeal, and that's the lower friendship. The lesser love is the bodily love, and the greater love is the rational love. And that's something that can only happen with men. And so men they're intimates of one another. They know each other's deepest, darkest secrets. They are, you know, physically also very proximate, right? They all go to the bathhouse together, and at least that's what I'm imagining reading Ghazali's passages, and Tusin Devani as well talk about the kinds of friendships and that men are supposed to have with one another, and they're talking about real intimacy, you know, real meeting of the hearts and minds, you know, and that is the limit of that is that it's all cerebral and that the corporeal is relegated to the lowly. And, you know, one can also think about it in terms of, well, you know, it's with women that you have corporeal love because they have less intellect anyway, and that's in their embodied and imminent, and men are transcendent and intellectual, and it's with them that you have this rational love, and that's the best love. And all three of them sort of praise, particularly Tusi and Davani praise the rational love as the best kind of love. So they also talk about hugging and kissing in various different episodes. When, you know, there's this episode that Ghazali describes as of a friend who of a friend who was fell victim to a prostitute's guiles. And this friend, he praises this friend for going and bursting in on them and removing him from her home or whatever, her dwelling, that where his friend had sort of gone off to for months and disappeared. And so the friend, you know, the way that his friend brought him back to his senses is that he hugged him, he kissed him, he embraced him. And it was this, you know, hello, welcome back to reality. And what are you doing with this prostitute and indulging your complicated faculty? And the best friend is obviously the one who reminds you of the true path to refinement. You know, there is this physical intimacy as well, but the pre-modern heteronormativity is such that there is this line where women are really the corporeal love is to be directed, and men are entirely cerebral.
So in light of the things that you found in these three texts, there is the question of then what do we do with this, right? Because you are saying that you found, gendered metaphysical tensions, there's heteronormativity that's being presented, it's male-centered. Can we really glean from these texts in our contemporary contexts? If so, how do we approach it? And you guide us through or take us to this notion of a philosophical turn that we need to do based on gender. And so what is it that you think is important for these texts to be read in our contemporary light?
Yeah, I mean, I think the texts... It's funny because I feel like I spend the whole book bashing them, and then I sort of come back.
Yeah, you're fine. Okay. I found that very interesting. Yeah. And in many ways, it's because I think you highlight too that these texts are being read, right? You present us with Amazon review comments that other people are just reading and leaving comments, and women have read these texts and all of a sudden come to the reality that, oh, Ghazali is not talking to me. He's talking to men. So, if there is an importance, because these texts are popular, then, you know, what is that importance?
Yeah, exactly that, right? So these are beloved texts, right? So there isn't a person who is, you know, a college graduate in Iran or in Pakistan or in India or, who won't know these texts, right? These are really, really widely loved and read, and you know, even on Amazon and Kindle and Goodreads and God knows what other, you know, sort of platforms, and there's these, you know, and they're short, small abridged versions that are, you know, made for lighter reading and so on and so forth. So there's a lot, they're widely circulated, widely read, and a lot of people find them compelling. So they're even in their English translation, lots of people are reading them and saying, okay, this is inspiring. This is meditative. This is, there's so much insight about, you know, about myself and how to live in this world and so on and so forth. And people are really drawn to them. And so it behooves us to engage with them philosophically because they're also really problematic, right? So I talk about these four kinds of four sort of issues that recommend the texts, right? So they talk about rationality as being, you know, a common denominator, something that, you know, lots of people like to get behind. They talk about how an individual can become a force for justice, right? I mean, they talk about how one is supposed to inculcate good behavior, and so on and so forth. And so there are all these positive things that people are drawn to, and yet, it's what the biggest problematic thing is that, you know, what is the meaning of the refinement if it's only open to a certain number of people, a certain type of people, right? To elite men, and how can these texts possibly be even the gems of the texts, right, that are speaking to everybody, that, you know, that are compelling, that the parts of these texts that make them enduring, that allow them to be enduring in the minds of people who are interested in Islamic philosophy or akhlaq, even those very aspects, right, which generally are, you know, the issues about the particularly like how did we find the nafs and things like that, those are specifically, as I talk about in the book, achieved through subjugating others or excluding others, right? So a person can't be ethically refined, according to Ghazali, Tusi, and Dawani in that tradition, unless they treat their wife in a certain way or have their wife holding them up, propping them up in order for them to achieve refinement and you know, have the opportunity to order their household in certain ways, right? So it's not possible to be ethical unless one treats one's underlings in a certain way or enslave people in their home and their household in a certain way. And you know, the opportunities to, you know, one can say, okay, sure, you know, it's, you can just say that, you know, everyone should just treat everyone well according to the akhlaq rules and we're good to go. Yeah, but the problem with that is that the akhlaq texts, they require a kind of hierarchy, and they require certain people to be subjugated by others in order for some elite to achieve, right? And so it becomes an akhlaq of exclusion, and that very well is contradictory to the goals of akhlaq itself, which is, you know, one of the major arguments of the book. But to your question about moving forward, then, you know, so they are compelling texts, and to move forward, one of the things that I talk about is, well, there's actually four major things that I talk about. One is thinking through the very definition. I mean, the overarching one is thinking through the definition of humanity, right? So the problem is that humanity is defined as rationality in the texts, and that needs to be broken down into sort of liberating reason, right, from the exclusionary definition, because from this exclusionary definition of humanity as rationality, right? Because when you define humanity as rationality, then you sort of open up this can of worms of, you know, yeah, sure, that's a standard definition. All thinking people are people, right? But not everyone has the same kind of intellect. Are they less human? You know, and certainly, you know, they're from disability studies, we can talk about how the definition of rationality or definition of human as rational is really problematic, because you know, there are lots and lots of people that are completely human that are unable to have that capacity for reasons that are beyond my control, for natural reasons. And so if you appeal to nature as a natural definition of humanity, of human as the rational and thinking animal, that's problematic. I also talk about how the concept of khilafa, and that's something that I haven't mentioned in our conversation, but I describe men's station as the elite sort of orderers of the cosmos, of the family, of society, and ultimately the universe, is actually described using the term khalifa and khilafa in the texts. And if the goal of the text is sa'adat, our ultimate happiness, flourishing, and khilafa of the human being, well, that's very much described in those patriarchal terms that we've been talking about. Deconstructing the notion of vicegerency or stewardship, some people like to call it, from patriarchy is another thing that we need to sort of think deeply philosophically about. And that requires us to think about, you know, the ways in which Halacha has been considered in patriarchal terms. And then also elite-only access to ethics sort of oftentimes recreates hierarchies, right, along various other planes. So if we talk about gender only, that still, you know, sort of oftentimes offloads hierarchical dynamics onto, you know, onto race and class and other sorts of issues. And so trying not to raise that is another issue that we need to think about philosophically. So intersectionality, the place of intersectionality in advocating for people's access to refinement. And then finally, the very sort of fundamental issue of utilizing others for elite male refinement, right? So the goals of a flock themselves need to be rethought sort of philosophically. If the goals of a flock are achieved only through utilizing others, then certainly the goals need to be rethought. And that would require deep philosophical reflection as well. So that's where I end the book, actually, is to advocate for engaging with these texts philosophically, because they are so important, and they speak to perennial issues, right? Perennial concerns about how to live as human beings, and the definition and very understandings of humanity. You know, whether or not one reads them from a faith-based perspective, the texts are addressing sort of larger questions that are not limited to the Muslim tradition. And that's why I think engaging with them philosophically is important.
The book has certainly raised very important questions and has given me a lot to think about. And there's so many details, important details, that we didn't even get to in our conversation. So I highly recommend our listeners to pick up the book. I'm sure our listeners are also interested in knowing what you're up to these days, if there's a new project that you're working on that we could expect down the road.
You know, I call for a philosophical turn in the study of gender and Islam in the book, and I my next project is actually my attempt at doing just that, making that philosophical turn myself. My next project is actually also an ethics project. I'm looking at contemporary things, issues of how Muslim thinkers as well as Muslims themselves think of women as human beings. And I'm looking at bioethics decision making in particular, and American Muslim women's experiences in bioethics decision making as a way of asking, getting at those issues, getting at those questions. So when it comes to matters of life and death, right, how have Muslims thought of women as persons? So and how does, and who makes decisions for them, and what kind of religious authority, what kind of gender assumptions do religious authorities make, or medical authorities make, and Muslims themselves make in thinking about life and death for women? So that's the next project, as well as just sort of other sorts of projects that are smaller projects that are also likewise thinking through issues of philosophical ethics.
Wow.
And gender issues.
That sounds amazing. I look forward to reading your future work. And seriously, thank you for an amazing book and an amazing conversation. I really enjoyed reading it, and it was provoked in many ways. I'm grateful for that. So thank you again for your time with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much for asking such great questions.